The Outpost Radio on Demand. Here's Art Young from the Outpost Magazine.
Is it possible to tell the story of a 2,000-year-old sport by showing the gear used over that period? Hi, I'm Art Young. I'm the editor of the Outpost Magazine, and our guest today has done just that and beautifully. The author of the new book entitled The History of Fly Fishing in 50 Flies is Ian Whitelaw, and he joins us via phone from his home in British Columbia. Welcome to the Outpost, Ian.
Thanks, Art. Good morning to you.
Yeah, good to have you here. What you have done, I think, seems like the impossible. I mean, along with your illustrator, you've created an illustrated history of angling, and you've done it chronologically via 50 iconic flies. First of all, bravo, and secondly, what in the world were you thinking? this is challenging, to say the very least.
It was. There's no question about that. And the 50 flies, the choice of them was extremely difficult. And it kind of mutated and transformed as I went through. The list started out in one form and ended up pretty much completely different. The challenge really was to find 50 flies, not necessarily that are best known by everyone. In fact, a lot of these are probably very little known. But flies on which I could hang the history of fly fishing. And it's not just it's not really just about the development of flies. It's about the people who were involved. It's almost about politics in some cases. It's about the use of new materials. It's about our knowledge of the natural world and the insect life that particularly trout feed on, but it's not solely limited to fresh water or to trout. So, yes, the choice of flies was extremely the late 1400s. Where there's an early book that talks about fly fishing for the first time, written by a woman, interestingly. And there are people since then who, on the basis of 12 flies that she listed and described, have actually managed to tie these patterns. And we started there and then worked our way through trying to chart the changing history of the technology and the knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what is your background, Ian? How do you know so much about, the look of these ancient flies? Are you a historian? Are you a professional fisherman? What do you do besides write books?
Besides writing books, I'm actually a real estate agent in central Vancouver Island.
Nice. So I know somebody to call whenever I want to buy the home up there. That's good.
Absolutely. And if you want to come fishing, this is the place to buy a home. We've got just about everything going on here.
I'll bet that's true.
Steelhead and salmon and everything else. So my background is in editing and writing, particularly, and I love fishing. But this was a huge effort of research. I mean, this isn't the kind of information that you have at the top of your head. I don't think anyone would ever have all of that information. So a huge amount of research and a huge amount of help also from a surprising amount of help from people throughout the fly fishing world, some really well-known names around the world whom I literally phoned up and chatted with and asked for advice, and people were really forthcoming. It's been amazing, giving me photographs and information and suggestions. So it's a collaborative effort, for sure.
Yeah.
But yes, a lot of research.
Well, fly fishermen and women, as you mentioned, will love the illustrations in this book, and they are stunning. Who was your illustrator on this book?
It's actually my sister.
Wow.
She's a botanical illustrator, and she's a member of the Hampton Court Palace Florilegium in London. And she's done some quite amazing botanical illustrations. So I asked if she could turn her hand to fishing flies, and she did. And she's done these in watercolor, which proved to be a massive challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she's excelled herself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the brilliant touch of this book, the illustrations show how these flies can be tied, which, that's a brilliant idea. I don't think I've ever seen that done.
It is. I mean, it's not primarily a book about fly tying. There's enough information there for a good fly tyer to work out how to do it. But it's not an instructional book in that sense. But what we've done is we've taken each illustration, each of the 50 principal illustrations, and then highlighted the parts in separate little illustrations so you can work out what the ingredients for the recipe are, if you like.
Right.
And a lot of tyers would understand the order that would have to be tied in, and I'm sure would be able to tie it on that basis for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the idea, the beauty of the illustrations and, you know, all the materials and the colors that went into these things. This is a really interesting book. It's called The History of Fly Fishing in 50 Flies, and it's written by our guest today, Ian Whitelaw. Ian, let's jump back a little bit. How did fly fishing really officially start, if it ever officially started as a sport?
Well, presuming it was a sport, the first reference is in 200, after in the Christian era, if you like, year 200, and there are references to the use of an artificial fly in Macedonia. And then we don't read much more about what's happening until, as I say, 1490 or so, when Dame Juliana Berners, well, it's believed to be her, it's hard to know exactly who wrote it, but she wrote a sort of compendium of the knowledge about fly fishing that existed at the time. And so suddenly we see what looks like a fully formed sport. Now, presumably in the intervening 1,200 years or whatever, it had obviously been slowly developing. And interestingly, at that time, the first flies that she describes are pretty much replicas, or they attempt to be replicas, of adult flies as you'd see them sitting on a leaf kind of thing. But they didn't really necessarily float very well because the materials and the fact that the line itself was, when it was made of silk or other materials, would tend to sink. So the flies would sink beneath the surface, where you'd have a fly that was meant to look like, a fully formed adult, was under the water, and yet they seemed to be fairly successful. And we carried on like that for 300 years, really. And then gradually other forms of flies developed. If you look at the list of flies that she describes, they're pretty much recognizable today as the kinds of fly we would try to simulate for the fish. Then after that, we see essentially the materials don't change for a long time. They're natural materials. They are essentially wool and feather, and then actually not even fur at that time. And then gradually we see a change in the way that flies are being tied, and we see the development of the dry fly not until the mid-1800s. So there was a long period there where there seemed to be relatively little change. And then in the last, since the 1800s, we've seen just an exponential increase in the variety of flies and our understanding of what fish actually feed on. And I'm talking specifically there about trout flies, because obviously in the case of ocean fishing, generally they're bait fish imitations, and we've got several in here. And again, yes, there's variety within them and new materials, but it's primarily in freshwater flies that we see the enormous variety, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have the colors changed over the years? I mean, did they start off as very brightly colored hues, and are they more subtle now, or have they stayed pretty much the same in terms of color?
That's pretty hard to answer. I would say, in terms of color, probably not a huge amount of change overall, because there's always the attempt there to at least represent the natural. And therefore, your color palette, if you like, is somewhat determined by what the fish are feeding on. But we have seen a big change in materials. And there is an interesting progression, if you like, from these sort of stiff flies through soft hackle flies, which is one thing that interested me most in my research, is the use of softer hackles to produce a kind of movement under the water. Pulsating vitality, I think one of the early people describes it as. So that you see what looks like an insect that's drowning, rather than some kind of stiff replica of an adult that's being washed down the stream. And that was picked up, again, particularly in America. Well, initially by a guy called G.E.M. Skews in Britain, who was an advocate of nymph fishing at a time when dry flies were all the rage, but then in America as well. And there are some amazing patterns. They're actually generally very simple but very effective. Mm-hmm. So there's that whole trend of the soft hackle fly. And then the American side of the history, which is a very large part of the history, the British flies made their way over here, but it was soon realized that the flies didn't represent the hatches that take place here.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So you had perfectly formed flies on the British style that weren't very effective. So you have people like Gordon, who in the Catskills was developing his own colours and eventually his own style of tying. Catskill style of fly tying is now world famous. But he was attempting to create flies. The British dry fly was designed for the chalk streams of southern England, which are very placid and slow-flowing, very clear water. So when he brought these dry flies to England and used them in the Catskills on tumbling waters, of course, they just drowned and went under. So mm-hmm. he came up with new ways of creating a more buoyant fly. And then you have people like Lee Wolfe, and the Wolfe pattern flies use bucktail and other more buoyant materials to create larger flies that will stay on the surface of really rough water. So you see those sorts of trends going on.
Hmm. You've alluded to three or four. Another aspect of this book that I enjoyed was you feature key characters, and I emphasize that word characters of fly fishing. Who are some of your favorite from history?
Well, that's a pretty hard one. I mean, like Gordon is a good example because he seems to have been a bit of a loner. He never wrote any books, but he wrote a lot of magazine articles, and he just devoted himself entirely to fishing. Skews in Britain, again, a great character. He was a lawyer, and he used his sort of powers of oratory to defend the use of nymphs and wet flies on the British streams against a real tide of dry fly fanaticism. So
that's a very unusual expression, a dry fly fanatic.
Oh, well, no, it got really serious. I mean, they had big meetings to determine whether or not it would be allowed that you could take a nymph into some of these rivers. And they remain dry fly rivers. Several of them you're not allowed to use wet flies on to this day.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I don't know whether that's true in the U.S. I think it may be the case that there are some dry fly-only rivers. I'm not sure about that.
I'm not sure either, but I one would think that there would be, given as you said, the fanaticism of fishermen and fisherwomen. I suspect there's a dry fly-only area.
Yeah. No, I'm quite certain that that's going to be the case. You've got people like Al Troth, who invented the elk hair caddis, and that, again, is another world-famous fly. I'm just sort of flicking through the book in front of me. One of the, not so much a person, but the style that I really appreciate is the upside down fly. The idea there being with a dry fly, if you have the hook underneath, as you naturally do, it's unnatural. It's sticking through the surface of the water and it shouldn't be there. So there are several people, and again, going back to the 1600s, there were upside down flies being developed then, but they were wet flies. But now, upside down dry flies is a style unto itself, and they're really beautiful. They look bizarre when you hold them up, but if they're on the water, they produce a profile that's much more realistic than having the hook point underneath. And the ways people have solved that problem, there's many different ways, are quite fascinating. So I'm really, really impressed with those. There's a lot of flies here that I may have been aware of, but I'd never tied. I do tie flies, not terribly well. But in the course of doing the research for this, I did get involved in trying to tie many of them. I'm just looking here. There's a woman called Carrie Stevens, and that's one fly I wouldn't even dream of trying to tie because you'd have to have so much skill to do so. It's called the Grey Ghost, and it's really impressive. So I was rather fascinated by that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating topic. Just as someone like I do, I make a living writing. I can't imagine the research and the editing, you know, mental and literal of winnowing down the subject to 50 flies to tell the story of an entire sport. What do you think, Ian, makes the sport of fly fishing so popular?
Well, I've got a quote early on in the book from a good friend of mine in England, John Bailey, who's a fantastic fisher and a good writer as well. And he says, "No angler merely watches nature in a passive way. He enters into its very existence." And to me, that is one of the keys to why fly fishing is so addictive and so pleasurable. Is it's just such a wonderful excuse to be in a natural environment and participate in it. It's not a question of just sitting idly looking. You're actually actively entering into it in order to work it out. And I don't think anybody but an angler would appreciate the subtleties of a river or a stream, because nobody else is that interested, to be quite honest. But to be able to see, I think the same thing applies to some other sports. For example, I think in hunting, if you're going to spend long periods stationary in the wilderness, you know, you are going to learn and see an awful lot about the world around you. Skiers understand mountains like nobody else does. And fly fishers have a real insight, I think, into nature. That's the first element, is just, as I say, an excuse to enjoy nature. And then the second is the practical side, the skill, the craft of casting and fooling a fish. And then the third, to me, is fly tying, which a lot of anglers don't get involved in, but to me it's an important part of it. That's the art side of it. It's an art and a craft and a skill. So it's got everything going for it, in my opinion, fly fishing. It's also so lightweight. You don't have to carry great bags of gear. You
That's good. Good point.
Stuff it all
good
in
point.
A waistcoat.
Yeah, good point. I like those golfers who have to carry around 200 pounds of stuff. You've got a fly rod and a reel.
Yeah, exactly. It couldn't be easier. So you can hike and you can go to more difficult places without having to carry a great big backpack. Yeah.
Well, the history of fly tying and 50 ties, I mean, it's a stunning book. I think it's a must-have for anyone who loves the sport. It's also a great gift idea, and if you have a serious or casual fly fisherman, he or she would love this book. You can find it at your local bookstores or at Amazon.com. Best of luck with the book, Ian.
Thank you very much. I would like to make one last point, which is...
Sure, absolutely.
There's not just 50 flies in there. There's probably more than 200 that are described or illustrated or discussed. Just a quick example, if you take... There's an early fly called the Palmer worm, and it was tied in the 1600s. But by the end of that little chapter on that fly, we're up to date with the woolly bugger and with all sorts of other flies that are derived from it. So each fly, as I say, is we've hung the history on the 50, but it's not just about 50 flies.
Yeah, there's a lot of flies in there and a lot of good stuff. Again, thank you for joining us today, Ian.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. For The Outpost On Demand, I'm Art Young, and we'll talk soon.
The Outpost Radio On Demand, from the on-demand page of theoutpostlife.com.